Anya was standing in front of the statue. Joan held the uniquely shaped sword high above her head, her expression a study in determination.
Do you need a leg up?
No, I think I need you to have your hands free. Not sure what will happen or what we'll find.
I'll grab you a chair from the chapel.
The seconds he was gone felt like an eternity, and every nerve in Anya's body tingled.
You do the honors. I'll watch your six.
I'll need the...
Oh, yeah.
He pulled the scabbard out from where he'd safely tucked it in his jacket. Her hands were trembling so hard when he handed it to her, she feared she might drop it.
Are you okay? You seem nervous or something.
I'm fine. Just the excitement of the unknown, you know?
In reality, she was not okay. Her heart was thundering in her chest, and sweat started to dot her brow.
Here goes nothing, eh?
We've spent a lot of time together in the last 48 hours, Ben, but not once have you said A.
Well, you know, sometimes there's no better word. Go for it, Anya. I'll be here.
Standing on the chair, Anya was looking Joan right in the face. The statue was beautiful in its simplicity, detailed yet smooth, Joan's expression strong yet soft. It was one of the more impressive likenesses she'd ever seen. She wondered for a moment why the statue was hidden out of view. It seemed like a piece of art worth showing off in the main sanctuary, or even outside. Then she remembered she had a job to do. She took one more glance at Ben, who looked up at her encouragingly. She carefully slid the scabbard over the sword. Suddenly, the chapel was gone. The entire world fell away, reeling out of her brain. She was still and yet moving. It was dark, and yet her senses were overwhelmed. Everything felt cold and distant, but she felt her skin warming up in a slow and painful burn. A series of frightening voices began to bring her out of the darkness. An angry mob surrounded her on all sides. People in tattered coats surged forward, while soldiers with spears and swords held them back. But she could hardly see them, because her vision was blocked by flames rising up in front of her. She felt the heat. She felt smoke searing her lungs, thick and toxic, making it nearly impossible for her to speak or even cry out in pain. The fire had reached her feet and legs, burned the clothes away, and were singeing her flesh. The people could see that they were too late to save her. Through the small breaks in the flames, she could see the crowd turn their protest into a battle. She watched death all around her, people falling, screaming in anguish, the soldiers doing their best to keep them from saving her. She could feel this memory begin to fade, and again she felt like she was falling. Out of the corner of her eye, she saw a wooden cross on top of a staff. She couldn't see who was holding it up, but it was a solid, steady image in the midst of the chaos roaring around her. Somehow, through the smoke and the fire and the anguish, she felt the words rise up inside her.
Un crucifix! Montrez-moi un crucifix! Le Christ, mon sauveur, me livre à vos seins! No! Stop! Help me!
Anya! Shh! It's okay. It's okay.
Where am I? Ben?
I'm right here with you. Calm down.
As she tried to get her breathing under control, Anya let herself lean into him. Ben just held her there on the floor of the chapel, rocking her until the panic passed.
What? What just happened?
I don't know. You slid the scabbard onto the sword and then you just froze. All the color drained out of your face, and you didn't react when I said your name. You were just gone.
How long?
How long were you out of it? Only a few seconds, but it seemed like forever. I was just about to climb up on the chair with you, and then you started screaming, and you fell. I'm glad I was here to catch you.
Huh. Me too.
Anya gradually realized that it felt warm and wonderful and comforting, sitting here, wrapped in Ben's arms. She also remembered that they were in the Cathedral of Notre Dame, and their time was limited.
I think I'm okay now.
Ben released her and sat back.
Sorry. What the heck was that?
No, no, please don't be sorry. I appreciate you being there for me. And I don't know, that was probably just a lot of adrenaline and not a lot of sleep. Hey, wait, did anything actually happen when I put the scabbard on the sword?
Oh, good question. I didn't really notice because I was worried about you.
They looked around the statue and the panels on the walls of the chapel surrounding it, but didn't see anything.
I guess it was too much to hope that something would just pop out of the base of the statue.
Or something would descend from the ceiling.
I definitely remember feeling something click when I put the scabbard on the sword. I thought maybe I had released some kind of mechanism.
Well, this might seem silly, but should we try turning it?
Turning the scabbard on the sword?
Well, it is a key.
The prospect of climbing up and making contact with the statue a second time got Anya's heart racing.
Oh, okay. You look panicky. Why don't I give it a try?
Yeah, good idea.
Okay, let's see.
He grabbed onto the hilt of the sword with one hand and the center of the scabbard with the other and gave it a quick, sharp turn.
See, you get to be indie after all.
Ben was beaming as he stepped down from the chair to stare at the newly created hole in the base of the statue. Brooke had quickly switched out of her black tactical gear and into something a little more unobtrusive. The cathedral was only a 10-minute walk from their warehouse lair.
You there yet?
Arriving now.
Brooke had made the decision to leave Wilson back at HQ, both as technical support and because she knew the young hacker had very little experience in field operations. When this whole thing started, she had been the rookie. Now she was calling the shots. Despite the fact that she had lost all but one member of her team in less than a day, she was determined not to let her first command be a total failure.
What do you see?
There's a line of people milling around waiting to get in. A sign says the cathedral is closed for an emergency cleaning. What does that mean?
Someone spilled the communion wine?
Funny. Catching anything on the police bands?
Mostly quiet. Okay. That's weird.
What's weird?
There's nothing on the regular bands, but I switched over to a less used channel and there's all kinds of chatter. Damn. Canadian Special Forces are positioned all around you.
I don't... Wait, got one.
One? Try 10 snipers on the rooftops. And don't make eye contact with anyone in that crowd in front of the church. They are packing some serious heat.
Brooke scanned the crowd and there they were, telltale bulges in their winter coats. One guy with his finger placed firmly in his ear. And what the hell was an ice cream cart doing on the street in January?
What are you gonna do, boss lady?
We do as we were told. We observe and do not engage.
Well, that was cool.
The space that had opened at the base of the statue was roughly the size of a shoebox. In the chapel's dim light, nothing was visible inside.
Okay.
Okay, what?
I guess one of us should see what's in there.
Yes, that would be SOP. You got a flashlight?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Ben knelt on the floor and peered into the space.
Okay.
Would you stop saying that and tell me what's in there?
What I assume is one heck of a big ruby.
Ruby?
Anya knelt next to Ben and peered into the space. The ruby reflected the beam of the mini mag light from atop a small wooden box. The stone was roughly cut and dusty, but still large and beautiful.
Yep, that is one big ruby.
Is that what all this has been about? One big ruby?
No, this is just the tip of the iceberg, if my source is to be believed.
Anya reached in to grab the ruby and handed it to Ben. He shifted to a sitting position, holding the enormous gem in the palm of his hand.
Holy smokes.
Anya carefully slid out the box and noticed a folded sheet of paper with a wax seal underneath it. She slipped it into her inside jacket pocket.
We should get out of here. Let's get this all back to McGill.
The weather had taken a definite downturn since Brooke's arrival at the church. Ice pellets rained down from on high, stinging her wherever they contacted exposed flesh.
Goddamn Canada.
Brooke Flynn hated winter. She had grown up just outside Tampa, and anything under 70 degrees was a reason to break out a parka. The combination of Lane's death, having their cover blown in the tunnels, the car chase inside the mall, and now freezing her ass off, all contributed to the ball of rage and stomach acid that was boiling up inside her.
Anything happening?
No, and stay off the line unless it's important. If you can hear them, they are perfectly capable of listening in on us.
The crowd had thinned when the wind picked up. Once the sleet started coming down, everyone left except the ice cream man and the fake tourists, who were no longer fooling anyone. Brooke had at least found an archway across the street to lurk in, which sheltered her from the sleet and some of the wind. Suddenly, the doors to the cathedral opened, and her targets were moving quickly down the steps onto Rue Notre Dame. They turned right, and then right again, onto the Rue Saint-Sulpice, taking them down towards the waterfront. She was about 100 yards away and knew better than to simply start following them. Brooke watched as two of the fake tourists broke off from their positions on the steps and started after them. Everyone else moved off en masse in the opposite direction.
Targets are in motion.
Affirmative.
She didn't want to draw too much attention to herself, but fortunately, the weather gave her a legitimate reason to jog across the Place d'Armes.
Damn it!
Rookie mistake. She had been so fixed on her target, she was nearly run over by a taxi while crossing to Rue Saint-Sulpice. She reached the narrow street that ran along the north side of the cathedral. There were her targets, halfway down the block, getting into an old Ford Escort. One of their watchdogs was stationed next to their car, while the other one, in a hockey jersey and a knit cap, stood between her and the targets on the opposite side of the street, in front of what appeared to be a store window featuring several suggestively shaped native wood carvings. This would be tricky. But she knew what she had to do. She stepped in front of their car.
Sorry!
She leaned over, seeming to check her leg where the bumper had grazed it, and casually planted a palm-sized tracking device under the car's front bumper. Giving a little wave, Brooke stepped onto the curb, and the old Ford puttered away. Just off the campus of McGill University, Rahul Varun waited in the presidential suite on the top floor of the Hotel Omni Mont Royal. The large windows provided a panoramic view of the city. Even through the sleet, Varun could make out the green mountain that gave Montreal its name. He was enjoying a club soda as he watched the lights along the skyline come to life. Even this horrible weather was unlikely to keep the active nightlife of the city at bay.
Yes?
Mr. Varun, Miss Creed and Professor McKittrick have left the cathedral and are making their way back to the university.
Thank you. Please keep me posted. If they leave the university, let me know immediately. I wish to have a conversation with Miss Creed about the treasure.
Of course, Sahib.
Varun watched as the raindrops chased one another down the window and thought about the other cities he had seen from the windows of other hotel suites. He had been searching for the stones for many years, and now one of them was finally within his grasp. Perhaps a wrong would be righted, and he could find peace.
Well?
Well, what?
Ben and Anya made their way down the central stairs of the same lecture hall where they had met the night before.
Did it work? You could say that.
Anya set the ruby onto a pile of loose blue books on the professor's desk.
Holy crap.
Doug's eyes opened wide when he saw the hen's egg-sized gem. Diana's eyes opened wide, then rolled.
That's it? My kidnapping, the falling pirate ship, the Blues Brothers car chase in the mall was all for this red rock?
Red rock? This is a huge-ass ruby, pea-brain.
But there's only one, dumbass.
Kids, I didn't say that this was all we found in the cathedral.
Anya opened her backpack and carefully lifted out the obviously old wooden box. She set it on the desk.
Jeez, we thought the ruby would make a big splash. Who doesn't like a gem the size of a tangerine?
More lemon-sized.
Lime.
Enough already. We saved the grand opening for the two of you. This is as much your discovery as it is ours.
The professor opened a desk drawer and took out a folded velvet cloth. He laid the velvet out on the desk, then moved the ruby and the box onto it. And both archaeologists put on their rubber gloves.
This box is so simple compared to the other one. It looks like a really old cigar box.
Ben then opened the box. They all stared at the contents.
Well, that's anticlimactic.
A rock. And a piece of paper.
And the paper's nothing special. It's sealed with wax, but it doesn't bear any sort of sigil or mark.
Paper and a rock. All we're missing are the scissors.
Diana smacked Doug on the back of the head.
Hey!
Act like you got sense, and the beatings will cease.
Is that a valuable rock?
Looks like milky quartz. In other words, no.
Hang on, everybody. Let's see what the paper says.
Ben squinted at the paper and adjusted his position so the overhead lights shone on it directly.
It's in French. That's to be expected, I guess.
What does it say?
Ah.
He's doing this on purpose, isn't he?
Okay. This seems to be precise instructions on where to find the lost crown jewels of France.
No riddles? No codes?
Here, you can read it for yourself.
Ben placed the letter on the table, and both Anya and Diana squeezed in to read the cramped writing.
1830 is the year the cathedral opened.
Well, this changes things.
I know. I'll start packing.
Would anyone care to let me know what's going on?
It says that the treasure we are looking for has been moved. It was sent to the estate of the Dubuc family in Martinique. There is a well in the main courtyard of the Chateau Dubuc on the Bay of Galéon. Look for a stone that is a brother to this one, and you will find the treasure. Sell the ruby to provide funds for the expedition. What remains of the treasure should only be recovered when a Bourbon is returned to the throne. Bishop Jean-Jacques Lartigue, May 26, 1830. Long live the true king of France.
Martinique? I've been there.
You have?
Not only that, I've been to Chateau de Bec.
Chateau du Bec.
Right, like you said. It's a big estate with the ruins of an old house and a working rum distillery.
And now we know why you were there.
It was spring break, okay?
What else do you remember?
These Dubuc people were big movers and shakers on Martinique. Their land was pretty isolated, so they brought in illegal goods and slaves. I think they abandoned the place at some point and moved into town.
Diana started banging away at her laptop.
What do you know? That was actually useful information.
Gee whiz. Thanks, Dee.
Got it. The Dubuc family came to Martinique from Normandy by way of Norway. The chateau was built in the early 17th century, and by 1770 they had abandoned it because of hurricane damage. They moved into the town of Trinité. Oh, this is interesting. The family included a guy by the name of Louis-François Dubuc du Gallion.
LFDG. The final initials carved into the box.
He was the president of the Colonial Assembly in Martinique. He came into conflict with the French Revolutionary government and snuck over to London to make a deal with the English. In 1793, they signed the Treaty of Whitehall, which placed the island under English protection and stipulated that it would return to France without compensation when a French sovereign of the Bourbon family was restored to the throne. Well, that sounds like our guy! When do we leave?
Sorry, Diana. We don't.
What?
You, Doug, and Ben have been in way too much danger here. I have to assume things won't be much better in Martinique.
Don't you think that's our call to make?
No, I don't. Look, you've all been extremely helpful and should be very proud of the work you've done. But it'll be better for all of us if I go on alone.
Does that include me, Miss Creed?
Anya, who is she?
This is Antoinette Leroy, the woman who had you kidnapped to use as leverage for a personal treasure hunt. Isn't that right?
She's right, my dear. And I offer my humblest apologies to both you and your brother.
I hope there are no hard feelings.
Sure, no hard feelings. Just don't get too close. I tend to punch people who kidnap me.
An understandable sentiment, my dear.
Is she drunk?
Of course I'm drunk. If you had just quit a very important job with Canadian intelligence to chase down a family legend, wouldn't you be drunk?
Probably.
What are you doing here, Antoinette?
After I arranged your play date at the cathedral, one of my bosses, one I didn't even know existed, began to ask some pointed questions about squandered manpower and double overtime. And the long and short of it is I find myself in need of a new job, and it would probably be better if I wasn't in Canada come morning. Martinique sounds lovely.
I don't remember saying that you could come with me.
Miss Creed, whether you like it or not, we have a partnership. Besides, wouldn't you like to have some backup? Someone who would be easily disposable if the situation calls for it. It's not like I would be missed.
Self-pity, Antoinette? Really? Considering what the people around you have been through in the last couple of days because of your little scavenger hunt, that is frankly insulting.
You are right. Now I need to sit down.
Anya, I get that you don't want to put people in danger, but we're not sending you off to Martinique with a drunk spy.
It's not ideal, but I have been on my own before.
What I'm saying is you don't have to be. You're right that Diana has to stay here.
What?
But Doug and I can make up our own minds about whether we put ourselves in danger.
Yeah, about that. I think I better hang back here and keep an eye on Diana.
What?
Listen, Anya does this stuff all the time. I'm a producer. I work best when I'm not in a jungle, where someone might have to drag my not very fit corpse home to Mom and Dad. And the same goes for you, Dee. There will be plenty of time for you to get your full head shot off in the jungle after college. Right now, leave it to the pros.
He's right, Diana.
Of course I am.
Okay, fine. But you know I've got mad research skills. You have to use me as tech support. I'm going to bombard you with intel as soon as you get to Martinique.
That would mean more to me than anything.
I'm going.
Ben.
No, listen. You are perfectly capable of taking care of yourself. That's incredibly obvious. And you've done a really good job of taking care of me, for which I am grateful. But I need this. I have been in love with archaeology ever since I saw the mummy.
Karloff?
Fraser. I've spent weeks in the field using dental instruments to excavate a square foot of an indigenous people's camping site, only to find nothing important. But here's the chance to actually find something that would matter. And I can't just let that chance slip away. It's not about fame or fortune or... You're an archaeologist, Anya. You know what I'm talking about. Please.
All right.
Really?
Yes. Now stop talking before I change my mind.
This is all very touching, but can we please get a move on? There's some very nasty gentlemen who would like to have a few pointed words with me in a very small room with poor ventilation and unflattering lighting.
Who said you're going? I wouldn't trust you to watch my back on a trip to the mailbox.
Anya, you need me.
I can't think of a single reason why.
Well, maybe you don't need me, but I need you. For years, I've tried to figure out why my mother was the damaged piece of work she was. And her mother before that. If generations of damaged children serve some greater purpose, maybe then I could start to forgive and move on. But right now, all I have are fairy tales and the half-crazed ramblings of a senile old woman. I need proof, and there's only one place I can get it. So either you let me come with you, or I'll go alone and be an itch on your back you will never be able to scratch.
Fine. But you're paying for the trip to Martinique.
Well, that could present a problem. They've frozen all my bank accounts. I've been cut off from my government contacts, and they'll be on the lookout for me at the airports and border. So you are going to have to smuggle me out.
How? In my duffel bag? Or maybe I can just whisk you away in my private jet.
And I believe that is my cue.
He looks familiar.
Someone needs to talk to campus security about this building. Anyone can just walk right in.
Good evening, Ms. Creed, Professor McKittrick. And I'm sorry, I haven't been introduced to the rest of your party.
You haven't been introduced to us either.
You are correct. I apologize for my earlier rudeness, but time was obviously of the essence in ensuring your escape. My name is Raoul Varun, and my family has been tied to the treasure you seek for longer than anyone.
I don't understand. We're supposed to be looking for the French crown jewels. You seem to be from the Asian subcontinent.
Yes, I am from India, Hyderabad to be precise. And it is a member of my family who stole one of the jewels that you seek. It is my wish to return it and thereby remove a curse from my family.
Mr. Varun, is it? I don't mean to be rude, but given your personal helicopter and that apparently expensive suit, it's hard for me to believe that you are cursed.
The nature of the curse is not one of misfortune in this world, but rather one of a more spiritual nature. The turning of the karmic wheel has been set against my family for nearly 400 years now.
What is the source of this curse?
Theft. Many years ago, two gems were stolen from a temple in what was then the city of Golconda. Two diamonds, one blue and one green, perfectly matched in size and shape, both found in the mines above the city. One night, a boy named Varun entered the temple and removed the diamonds from the eyes of the statue of the Blessed Sita in order to sell them to a European in the marketplace. Since that night, no Varun has achieved release from the cycle of rebirth and suffering.
Okay, wait. Let me get this straight.
Ben?
Drunk Mata Hari's however many greats grandmother, Marie Antoinette's chambermaid, hid the French crown jewels somewhere? Now that's a little hard to swallow, but I'm willing to go with it. But now, this guy's multiple greats granddaddy wrecked the family karma by stealing two big diamonds out of an idol's eye, so he's looking for the jewels too? And just by coincidence, all this weirdness converged on Montreal of all places and caused kidnappings and shot up museums and car chases in crowded malls and helicopter rescues and God knows what else. Now we need to go all the way to Martinique to figure this out?
Yep, that's it in a nutshell.
But stuff like this just doesn't happen. Not in the real world. Does it?
In my experience, yes, it does.
Ben just stared at Anya. So did Diana, her mouth agape. Doug had a satisfied smirk on his face at Diana's reaction. Mr. Varun waited patiently, his expression neutral. Antoinette appeared to be on the verge of dozing off.
Ben, I know this is a lot to take in. If you want to change your mind and stay here, no one will think less of you, least of all me.
No, I'm going. In for a penny, in for a pound. What the heck?
All right, Mr. Varun, what do you want in return?
To take the stolen diamond home.
You said there were two diamonds.
Indeed there are, but one of them is completely out of reach for the moment.
Another lost treasure?
Not lost, but in the custody of an American museum whose security is quite formidable. You have probably heard of it. They call it the Hope Diamond.
You're saying that the Hope Diamond has a little brother, only in green?
Actually, the green stone is larger, as it has not been recut the way the Hope Diamond has.
How do I know that you're not just trying to get the diamond for yourself?
Miss Creed, as you have seen, I am a man of many resources. If my goal was to take the stone for myself, this room would be filled with armed men. If their presence was not enough to persuade you to give up the items I need to find the jewels, I would simply have them kill you.
But that would be more bad karma for the Varun family.
Indeed, yes. You are fortunate that my family is so important to me. May I count on your help?
What are you offering?
A private jet to Martinique for any of your party who wish to continue this quest, plus ground transport to the site once we reach the island. And my personal security force, which is already en route, will provide logistical and defensive support. Is that satisfactory?
Well, I'd have to say yes, it is. Diana and Doug, I still need you to dig up everything you can about the chateau the Dubuques, and anything else you think we might need to know about Martinique.
Right.
You got it.
Ben, are you still sure you want to do this?
I'm sure that if I don't do this, I'll never forgive myself. Providing I survive.
Well, with the assistance of Mr. Varun and his security forces, I think there's a pretty good chance you will. And Antoinette, it's time to sober up. Antoinette!
Yes! There's no need to shout!
Antoinette, I need you to be awake, alert, and fully functional 100% of the time on this venture. Otherwise, I will hand you over to the Canadian government faster than you can down a fifth of Jack Daniels.
You insult me, Miss Creed. I am a professional. I never imbibe while on a mission. May I have a drink on the plane?
Mr. Varun, it's your plane.
I'm sorry, Madame Leroy, but I do not stock spirits on board.
Very well.
Varun caught Anya's eye and raised his eyebrows. She smiled faintly in return. It had been easy for Brooke to follow the professor's junker back to McGill with the transmitter in place. The sleet had turned into light snow as the temperature dropped. Nothing significant, but just enough to make the streets slippery and cover the grassy areas. She had found a covered bus shelter from which to watch the entrance to the anthropology hall. But the shelter did nothing to stop the cold from spreading up through the soles of her shoes and then into her feet. It had been about an hour since she had taken up her position. Since then, she had seen several students and professors leaving the building. The only two people who had entered the building were a tall, well-dressed, middle-aged woman who slipped on the way up the steps, and a handsome brown-skinned man in a very expensive suit and no coat who had arrived in a limo. The limo had been idling in a loading zone in front of the building for the past 45 minutes. If not for that fact, Brooke would have thought she'd been ditched. Now she was probably coming down with a cold. But to her relief, the main door of the building opened.
Finally.
Her targets were an odd bunch. Creed lithely covered the space to the waiting limo, while the professor helped the unsteady lady down the slippery steps. The Indian man stopped to speak to the driver, who had come out of the vehicle to open the doors. Brooke needed a plan. There was no way to get a tracker on the limo and not give herself away. She looked at the incoming number, and it was as nasty as a punch to the gut. It was her employer, no doubt calling to let her know she was fired, and she didn't blame him.
Yes?
Report.
Targets are on the move, and they have new company. There's a middle-aged woman with a drinking problem.
Madame Leroy.
You know her.
Her father is an old friend.
And a well-dressed man who looks like he might be Indian, like from India.
I don't know him, but if I had to guess, he is probably related somehow to your Uzi-wielding friends from the underground mall debacle.
Well, they're about to get away from me in a limousine. And there they go.
No worries. I have a means of tracking them. Get back to your warehouse. You are to destroy everything in the space, including any weapons, computers, or vehicles that may come back to haunt us. Find new transportation, a new laptop, and find somewhere out of the way to wait with Mr. Wilson until I contact you. Is that clear?
Crystal.
Good. Keep cooperating, and you may live to see the end of this, unlike your unfortunate former commander. Understood?
Yes, sir.
Ten minutes later, Brooke walked into the warehouse. Wilson had already started the final cleanup. Three cans of gasoline were lined up next to a pile of weapons, ammo, and the various debris that accumulates when seven people share a confined space for a week.
Ready?
Almost. Moving the last few files I need to back up.
Leave it. Instructions were to burn everything.
Alrighty then.
Wilson brought a hammer down on the laptop with a satisfied smile on his face.
Now wipe it.
Brooke picked up one of the steel fuel cans and splashed it onto the pile a few times, then proceeded to splash the heavier pieces of equipment around the room and the walls. Wilson picked up an item about the size of a car battery with a handle on top and iron surface on the bottom. He flipped a switch, and the electromagnet wiped the hard drive.
Cleaner than a fat kid's dinner plate.
Then he carelessly tossed the broken laptop onto the pile, followed by the electromagnet. Certain that she had covered all the equipment with a good dose of accelerant, Brooke put the fuel can down.
Open the door and start the car.
Okay, boss lady.
Giving the room a final once-over, Brooke couldn't help but feel defeated. When Lane Matheson asked her to join his team, she thought she was moving up in the world of private covert ops. Just like nearly every other profession, it was a boys' club. In the last 5 years, she could count the number of women she had worked with on one hand, and nearly all of them had been on the tech end of the business. She wasn't happy about Lane's death, but it had been the kind of opportunity she had been waiting for, an operation she could run on her own. Now, here she stood, wadded-up newspaper in one hand and a Zippo in the other, defeated. She crossed to the warehouse entrance, hit the button to close the door, and got into the car. But this wasn't over. She would wait for the call from the client, and wherever Anya and her team of weirdos were headed, she would be there. And the last woman standing would be her.